Welcome to New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I am your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital, and today I am very excited to have a single woman who is looking for, 5'9"? She's over there. You all won't see the video, but she's over there dying. So we'll see if we keep this in there or not. Marion Chivette. All right. And so let me get back in. She has a very broad range of experience in the financial service industry. I've noticed that you started out, looks like an insurance. You did some accounting. You've been a trader. And then it seems like the last, 7 years have been more on the investment analyst side. And today you're a senior portfolio manager, as well as a director of impact investing at Johnson Financial Group. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
Did I offend you too much by that?
No, I'm just a little sweaty, but that's okay.
Okay. All right.
It happens all the time, so it's fine.
Okay. Well, anyways, we're grateful to have you on the call today. And this is not the reason, but it is quite timely because next week we're going to be hosting a virtual summit on all things Africa. And from the conversation you and I have had, I know that that's near and dear to your heart. So we'll learn about that in a second. So tell us a little about yourself. Where did you grow up? Maybe where you went to school, and then just a high level of your career.
Well, I grew up in Kenya. It's kind of a big country, the size of Wyoming. It's in East Africa. And the best part is that we have a beach, which I never went to until last year. So it took a lot of time before I went there. But yeah, I grew up in Kenya. I grew up in a very small village. Can't tell you the number of people because my mom was a teacher. So we ended up moving every time she was going to teach in a different school. With that said, that comes a lot. My mom, she came up with a lot. Like, my growing up is always about my mom. She was a teacher. She raised 3 children by herself. And so she insisted on education. And so that was the cornerstone of our family was you need to have a good education and you need to care about it. And so growing up in a small village, something that most of us don't know is in Kenya for the longest time, women don't have any property rights. So if a family has any property, it always gets inherited by the son. And once the girl gets married, that's it. You don't have property at home. You're married, you belong to your husband's family. But my mom was very cognizant and very insistent on education. And it didn't make sense to me at that time. But it wasn't until I was older, and by old, I mean when I was in high school, that's when I realized what she actually meant. But, you know, just grew up in a small house, 2 rooms. I felt like we lacked nothing. Honestly, I didn't think that we were poor until we went to high school, because I went to high school in a big city. So that's when I realized me and my sister were like, yeah, I think we're poor.
So if you and I were to go back to your village and you were to show me your village, what would I think about it? Or I mean, just, you know, an American, so that you don't put me on the spot.
Well, you would have a lot of questions because there would be like, where do you cook? Where does everyone sleep in this house? Where do you sit? And where do you keep your stuff? And there would be so many questions that I ask myself those questions every day is, where exactly do we used to put all this stuff at night? And where would we sleep as a family? Mm. And you think about it, in Kenya, you just don't sit as a nuclear family. You have your extended family with you, because I had my uncle and a few of my cousins staying with us. So you are in like a 2-roomed house and there's like 6 to 7 people living in it. And somehow we all slept in it and kept all our stuff there. It was exciting.
So now I'm going to digress for a second. And I don't even know how to ask this question, but let's just say you're in America and you see the way you grew up and then you see the way that an American grew up. And I get there's a range there. Mm-hmm. But I would generally say that Americans would look at the way you grew up and said, oh, we feel so horrible for you the way you grew up. What would your comment be to that?
Why? That would be my question is why. We get 3 meals a day. I have a place to sleep that's not outside. I am with my family. That's just comfort right there. These clothes I can wear. I had everything I needed at that time. Everything else was extra.
And so today, however many years later, do you still feel that same way? Or has your perspective changed?
Perspective has changed a little bit because you don't notice what you don't have until you see other people having it. that comes with age, and it comes as you see other things and you see how other people lived. And so after living in America for close to 15 years now, we have built my mom a bigger house. She lives in a four-bedroom house with a kitchen, with a bathroom inside. Well, those things are not there, and it didn't seem like we were lacking at that time. Right now, it seems like, hey, you've raised four grown-up children who are very successful. It's time for you to just sit down and relax. And so you're providing all this extra stuff that you'd consider as luxury, but it's actually basic needs. She doesn't need to go outside to go to the bathroom at night. She can just mm-hmm. use the bathroom inside the house. So perspective has changed a little bit.
All right. So then tell us, where'd you go to school? I mean, did you go through high school and then come over? Give us a little bit of background there.
I went to a really good high school. It's called the Kenya High School. It was in Nairobi, in the big city. So it was about a 6-hour, 7-hour drive by bus, which was so exciting because to me, I was like, I'm going to the big city. That was the chance that you get to actually go to.
Would you live there?
Yeah, we had it was a boarding school.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a boarding school. Go stay there for 3 months, go home for a week, come back again, which was exciting to me because number one, I got to go to Nairobi and I got to sit in the bus for 6 hours. Trust me, that was fun because on your way there, you're seeing some zebras on the side of the road. There's some baboons. You know, the things that you take for granted, and you come here and you're like, I miss the times we'd be shutting our windows when the baboons wanted to grab your food. That was super exciting to me. But I went to a really good school. And with the persistence of my mom insisting that education should be number one thing, my sister and I went to the same high school. We were apparently smart enough that we got scholarships. So we ended up getting our schools paid for. So the school was a mix of kids from the village, kids from the city, the richest of the richest in the country, and the poorest of the poorest. And that's when my sister and I, one day, I remember clearly. So when you're in school, it's 3 months of a trimester. So 3 months, you got 2 visiting days in the 3-month period. So your parents can come visit you and bring you home-cooked food. They bring you all the stuff that you don't get when you're in school. So my mom would cook the basic things that we would usually eat for Christmas, you know, like she would make us some little baked goods. She would cook rice and chicken. Trust me, that was something that was very fancy. She'd just show up to school. So we're sitting there enjoying our meals, but my friends, their parents come with these shopping bags. It's got cereal. It's got powdered milk. It's got cookies in America, biscuits in Kenya. I'm looking at this and I sit there with my sister and I'm like, hey, do you think we're poor? She goes, oh yeah, we're poor. We've never seen that much shopping, even for Christmas. And that's usually like the best time of the year where you're buying all the stuff that you don't usually buy, like soda. But you know what the funny thing is? Once we get back to the dorms and you're all excited about all the stuff that your parents brought you, most of those kids who had all these shopping bags would come to us because we'd have like a community dinner where you're all sitting with your friends and you bring what your parents brought you and you're sharing. Most of the kids would be like, can I exchange the goods that your mom brought to you with this? My sister would be like, we may be poor, but we're freaking rich. So I think that was a different perspective for me. It was like, in as much as they had everything that we didn't have, they still wanted something from us, which was more than what I would ever imagine. My friend would get so excited that my mom is coming for visiting day versus her parents because my mom brings home-cooked food. Her mom brings store-bought food. And that made a whole lot of difference.
Yeah, I think it's human nature to compare and to want what somebody else has. And so appreciate you sharing that. Okay, so then you came to the U.S. and then tell us, where'd you go to school? And then a little bit about just your career.
I got recruited to the University of Wyoming, you know, in a small town, Laramie.
And so I know, I've been there.
You know, coming from Kenya, super excited. I'm going to America. Landed in Denver. I got $50. I was the richest kid in town. I was like, I have enough money. Converting that to Kenyan shillings, I had a lot of money in my pocket. And so I show up at the airport and my coach comes to pick me up with one of the athletes who was from Kenya. I pass by and he goes, Jumbo. I look at him and I was like, well, that's a weird person. Well, how can he just say Jumbo out of nowhere? Because Jumbo is like high in Swahili. And then my friend comes on. He's like, oh, hey, that's Coach Cole. And I was like, oh, hi. So I shake his hand and, you know, we drive back to Wyoming. Super excited. You know, it's August, still warm. And then something happens, you know, Wyoming, it's October, November. And my friends are like, you need to buy winter clothes. And I was like, sure. How cold can it be? They're like, oh, yeah, it snows. And in my head, I'm like, snow. I've never seen snow. I'm super excited. day one of snow, I am out there catching each and every snowflake, super excited. I'm just like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm looking at snow. Vividly, I remember one evening, my friend came to pick me up from my place and we go to practice and it's snowing like crazy. It's like big chunks of snow. We get to the field house and coach is like, oh, today we're going to do a short 5 mile run. I was like, oh, so we're running around the building? He goes, no, you're going outside. I was like, did you see what's happening out there? He goes, yeah, that's where you're running. So I was like, okay, not too bad. So I went running. I came back. My hands were so frozen. I made the mistake of putting my hand in hot water.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I thought it would warm it up quicker. Bad idea.
Bad idea.
As soon as I was over, I just went to coach and I was like, hi, is this a special thing this year or does it happen every year? He goes, no, this is Wyoming. I was like, I am out. And so I ended up transferring to Louisiana. And that's where I ended up finishing my accounting degree from.
So were you a cross-country runner?
I was cross-country and track.
Okay. So did you do that at Louisiana?
Yep. I did cross-country and track. So I graduated from a small school called Nicholls State. Everybody always asks me where that is. And I have to describe starting from New Orleans, then to a smaller town, then now to where my school is. You know, it was a small school, small town, kind of reminded me of where I was from in Kenya. It was just, you know, small town only with good roads and a lot of nice cars compared to my village in Kenya. It was bad roads, no vehicles. Tiny, tiny houses. Yeah, I finished my education there. And I think going to Louisiana was the best choice I ever made.
Why is that?
So at the University of Wyoming, it's a big school endowed with so much money. But, you know, in class, you're sitting there and there's like 40 of you. The attention of a professor to student wasn't that much. And so being in Louisiana, the largest class I had was like 25 students. By the time you get to your senior classes, there's like only 18 or 15 of you. And I was doing accounting. So I got the attention that I needed from class. I got the opportunities. I think it was more of like you're a big fish in a small pond, so you get all the opportunities versus being a regular fish in a bigger pond where you didn't get those opportunities that you would have.
All right. So again, I'm going to digress one more time. Now, none of this is in my blood and I did not do this, but my uncle, who today must be mid-60s, was a world-class marathon runner. So he was one of the originals that was sponsored by Nike back in the day. So give me a time, something that I can reference for you.
Regarding my running?
Yeah, give me a time. Come on.
Oh, gosh. Well, my best 5K was about 18 minutes and 42 seconds.
Holy cow. So what is that? High fives?
Yeah, high fives. Yeah, high fives.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's moving. If you had to just do a mile, how fast could you have done it?
At that point, man, depending on what day it was, I think you would have ranged between, if it's just a single mile, it would range between 450 and 550.
Got it.
I did not like distance running. I enjoyed track because I did the 400 and the 800 more than
Oh, that's a different.
Yeah.
So that was really your specialty was the.
Yes. My specialty was more on the 400 and the 800.
Oh, an 800's a brutal race.
Oh, that's brutal. You either go out fast and maintain or go slow and have the kick or just die on the field.
Now we're getting stuff I wouldn't necessarily know. What's a good 800 time for you?
Oh gosh, right now girls are running like 208, 207.
And what would you have been running?
I was like a 215 and 216. It was great for my university because I chose a smaller school, still D1. But if I was in University of Wyoming, that wasn't a great time. It was an okay time.
Do you run today?
Oh, yeah, constantly. I moved from the west because it was snowing, but now I can't stop running even when it's snowing. I love it.
Okay, and then so tell us what you're doing today.
Today, I am the Senior Portfolio Manager and Director of Impact Investment here at Johnson Financial Group. We are a multifamily office. And basically what my job entails is I run our investment team. We have about $3 billion in assets and we allocate those across majority of our investments are always going to be in private investments.
Okay.
A portion of it would be in public, but that's just, you know, ETFs, just very, very passive. We believe the alpha is in the private capital. I started here about in 2019 and had to like redo and rethink our whole impact platform. So I spent the majority of 2020 just bringing that up to speed, figuring out what our metrics are, how we want to invest. And right now it's about maintenance.
So you talk about impact investing as if it's just something you do and it's out there. And yet there's a fair amount of our listeners who are trying to figure it out, want to do it.
Yeah.
So is it that simple?
It can be. You can choose to make it as simple as you want it to be, or you can choose to make it as complicated as you'd like to be. It's all about the intention.
If somebody were to come to you, and again, this isn't investment advice, but if somebody were to come to you and just say, Marian, I want to do something in private space and around impact, how would you direct somebody like myself if I just said that to you?
My first question for you would be, what are your values? Do you want to invest with your values? Because if you're investing with your values, or you want your investments to reflect your values, then you're definitely doing impact investing.
Okay.
You can invest in something that ESG related, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're an impact investor. But if you have your values attached to where you want your capital to go, then you're an impact investor. So my first question for you would be like, how do you envision your capital doing for you? Or what do you want your capital to speak about who you are and what your values are? And then we can kind of go from there. Honestly, that's how I got to reach out clients and talk about impact investing, was a matter of just send out a note and be like, there's impact investing within it. This is the array of places where you can invest. And all the majority of those investments will give you a market rate return. And you have the goosebumps of, yes, I'm doing great out there. I'm making an impact.
Yeah, it's funny when we, obviously we've been in this space trying to educate advisors and others about impact investing. And I watch some advisors try to eat the whole thing all at once. And you're like, it doesn't have to be like that, you know? Just what you said is as simple as, hey, would you like to invest with your values? There's several different ways to think about that and just have a dialogue. But you'd be amazed how many people are afraid to even go down that path.
I agree with you, because it was a conversation that we didn't have. The first time we introduced impact investing within the firm, it was like, how do we know our clients would like it? I'm like, how do you know they don't like it? All you got to do is say what it is, and someone will tell you if they like it or they don't. And that's the approach we took, is like, we like working with people who have family foundation, people who want to make their capital do better for them. Mm-hmm. And so if you have that intent in the first place, whenever you bring up impact investing, it becomes, oh, this is what I do with my family. It's always an education moment. It's always like a light bulb moment where someone's like, oh, I didn't know that can happen. Yeah. Tell me more. And you delve into the subject and kind of expand on it from there.
Yeah. I've lived it myself. My longing is to have more and more advisors have those discussions with the investors. And really, my big passion on this impact investing is, yes, I care about issues and the way people invest. I do. But I actually care probably more about when I see people invest this way, it changes their psyche towards their investment capital. There's frankly a joy and a freedom that comes that traditional investing, it's just a number on a page, you know?
Exactly.
Not to say that it's not wrong. There's just a different paradigm. Okay, you've obviously in a great spot. You're working for a multifamily office of significant size. You're doing impact investing, helping the firm. How would you best describe who you are right now in the context of your life journey? It's a big question.
That's a very big question. I feel like I'm like a dot in this big old circle. It's like a white space and you're just like this dot in there. So depending on how much power or how much intentionality you have in there, that dot can blot into something big, or it can just stay a small. So in my mind right now, where I am, I'm just starting out. I'm just like taking my first step and looking at this white space. I'm like, there's so many possibilities. There's so many opportunities. There's so many things that I need to learn. There's so much I need to unlearn and grow as a person and just see where impact investing is going to go. It's not necessarily just purely that I'm targeting the impact investing. You can also be in the conventional investing and still make an impact in that area. There's a lot of opportunities. I'm just like, starting out with that little dot. So depending on how much power I have in it, I can either blot out the space or just keep making little dots around it, depending on how you look at it.
So you're in the starting point and you're in this building your capacity and then probably trying to figure out, where do I go from here?
Exactly.
The last question we're going to get to gets to your dream. So maybe that'll give you a perspective of where this dot can go. As you sit today then, and maybe where you're going, do you have a sense of how you want to help change the world, whether it be a little change or a big change?
I believe every step is a step towards change, as long as you keep going forward. And so it could be a little change. For me, it's always been about, it goes back to my story. My mom she raised girls in an environment that women are looked down upon. They are considered a second-class citizen, yet this woman is raising three children that she wants them to be very successful. And so in just thinking through that and her persistence on how education is supposed to be and how girls are being viewed in my community, I still say women are always the champs. Mm-hmm. For me, it's always, I'm standing on the shoulders of great women who advocated for me to sit in the spaces that I sit in. The least I can do is invite more women into that space and grow it. I show up in some meetings and I am the only woman in it. And I'm like, am I in the right meeting today or did I miss my directions? And if I'm in the wrong meeting, I'm going to make it a right meeting. You can always take the wrong bus, but it always drops you off in the right station. So
now when you think about what you just talked about, do you have a preference or desire to see change here in America or in Africa as it relates to women?
It's both. You know, if I look at the big picture, growing up in Kenya, looking at movies and having this perspective of what America looks like, and then you come here, it's like two different things. The reflection of what it is versus what is a little bit different. There's still a lot of progress to be made in this country as to where women can have seats on the table. The only difference is like this is a little bit ahead of where Kenya is. You cannot say that you want to make a difference in Kenya and just live here. I have grown up here. I have gone to school here. I have learned the system here. I feel like I have the best of both worlds. I've grown up in an impoverished country. I have seen what capital or what you need to be successful in that environment. I've made it to a place where the opportunities are almost infinite for me. Mm. I can use it to my advantage to serve both worlds. But charity always starts at home. And I consider both sides my home. So it's got to be both.
Got it.
And you can affect change in both of them. If look at what you're doing, you're in Florida, but you're directing capital to a continent that maybe you visit once or twice a year. So it's both.
Okay, so I'm fascinated to hear your thoughts on this. When did you realize the power of capital? And maybe what does the power of capital mean to you?
I think it was when I started as a trader. I had never seen a big portfolio. And at that time, honestly, from then till where I am today, that portfolio wasn't big at that time. I just had a client who had $700,000. And I was like, how do you get $700,000? Mm. To me, I'm like, whoa. But I think while I was working on there, we had one of those Sisters of St. Joseph's accounts, and it was an exclusionary account whereby not investing in birth control, cigarette companies, and things like that. In my arrogance and ignorance, I can say that is I was like, if you're buying a stock, it's going to be Jeff selling a stock from his portfolio to Marion. How does that affect the birth control portion? So I was like, it doesn't make sense. In hindsight, now that I look at it and what I've learned through my journey with impact investing and responsible investing is you have shareholder engagement in that portion whereby, you know, you buy a lot of shares and you sit down on the table and affect change in those areas. And so if I could go back and apologize to the Sisters of Joseph, to that point, I realized how much change you can make with money. I realized what difference that kind of money can make. If you can direct where you want your money to work, that is a very powerful position to be in. But also, you as an advisor, you as a financial planner, have that control as well, because you, most of the times, you're advising your clients on what to do. So you also have that power in you to direct capital where they're going. And that's what I do every day is in diligencing managers is I'm deciding, no, we're not going to put money with you, but guess what? We're going to put so much money with these guys because of maybe one or two things that they're doing differently than yours. Mm-hmm. So that is where I learned that capital is amazing and can affect change in so many ways that you can't even imagine.
One of the things that I always think about is even just the idea that we have the ability to go buy and sell stocks, not only by calling somebody, but today we can just pick up a phone. And in Africa, you can just pick up your phone and you can do it in fractional shares. And you're like, just the art of investing is an unbelievable gift that I don't think we realize.
Yes.
That we can actually put some of our capital and let it work for us as you go, man, that's the pretty cool thing. whether it's deemed impact investing or not, because you said it earlier, and you're right, every investment has an impact. The question is, how intentional are they about that? Okay, I'm going to pose this a little more specific to you. You come to the U.S., and obviously you're from Kenya. Mm-hmm. I'm going to assume that you're doing well financially. How do you think of stewardship personally in light of where you're at and where you're from? I'm assuming you still have family members in Kenya. So what does stewardship mean to you?
I think mine means a little bit different from what other people would say stewardship means. My mom is one of nine, and one of nine means she's the one who was helping the other nine with everything, like education. And then she has her own children, making sure that they're coming of age and being responsible adults. And as you look at me, like right now, today, I am my mom's IRA. So you're looking at this. This is my mom's IRA. But now it's not only my mom. It includes my grandmother, because she raised us while my mom was in college. You can't just ignore that and be like, oh, yeah, you're not my responsibility. Stewardship to me in that regard is to make sure that my mom does not lack. My grandmother is taken care of. But other than that, I do have cousins. We lost my aunt when one of my cousins was barely a year old. Who's going to take care of that? So you're responsible for teaching or helping those kids succeed. And at the end of the day, you start thinking about, where does this capital serve the best? Is it me just sending money to Kenya and just being like, oh yeah, you need to buy food? Or is it providing those opportunities that they can be able to stand on their own feet? So it's a mix of, for my mom and my grandmother, they cough, I am turning around and there goes money. But when it comes to your cousins, you know, my cousins and my uncles, it's a matter of, give me a plan. I'm not going to be funding everything today. So you're in a process of teaching people what that money means. Just because I am in the US doesn't mean that there's a money tree outside that I just harvest and send it over. I also work hard, but I want you to know that if I'm sending you this money, it costs me something. So can you make it worthwhile? So it's about teaching them about, what does that capital mean? I'm not just going to be funding you and your children. You also need to be able to stand on your own feet. So to me, stewardship in that regard has always been, how can I stop being that person that you're always coming to when you have issues? If I can help you stand on your own ground, is that going to help your children realize that you don't have to be asking someone else for money, that you can always establish yourself? It's different when you're pushing someone to do something versus helping someone to stand. So I'm always like, am I helping you or am I just nudging you to just take action? I teach myself what stewardship means to me. And then I have to transfer that to them and be like, all right, this is what's going to happen. It's going to fund this and this, and I need you to tell me how it goes. If it doesn't work, I'm sorry. Come back to me next time with, you know, if you want me to fund something, you have a portion of your skin in the game, and I'm going to bring in something on top of that. And guess what? This is a loan. It's not just me handing you something.
Has this been a good experience, or has there been bad experiences in all that?
Both, because it's family. Mm-hmm. And there's more than just being direct to the family member and being able to be like, okay, this is a lesson. And the perspectives are different. And also, I'm in the US. You know, it's a first world country. The relationship with money here is a different relationship with money in Kenya.
Expand on that for a second.
Here, we believe money can work for you. You get a job, save, start investing, think about how that money is going to help you when you retire. I sit in meetings and we have charts where you're talking to clients and like, at this age, you retire. At this age, you die. And then your wife will inherit this. And I'm like, excuse me, why are you telling the client that he's going to die? If I have that conversation in Kenya, someone's going to look at me and I'm like, excuse me, are you saying that I'm going to die? Why? When I speak about this and I'm like, we are going to die. It just depends on when you're going to die. And so those are conversations that don't come up there.
Why is that?
Because death is not something you talk about. Death is something to be feared. Death is something that surprises you. You know, it doesn't happen. It's just like, oh, whoa, he died. That wasn't expected. But how else are you going to exit? Here, the relationship is that money is supposed to work for you. If you work hard, save, you're going to live a comfortable life. With us, it now becomes, What does that mean to you? Is it today? Do I need to save for tomorrow? And if I save for tomorrow, what does a rainy day look like to me? And because in some cases, you're growing up in a family where there's a lack of it, when you get it, you want to hold on to it, that you don't do anything with it. You do have the money, but you're not making the money work for you.
Don't want to risk it.
No. Why are you risking something you've worked hard for? Keep it. So you find like savings accounts are larger and it doesn't work for you. Also, there's the relationships with a bank. In the US, if you have more debt, you get more debt because your credit is good. So, you know, I need to be in debt to get more debt. In Kenya, you need collateral. So I need to have that savings account so I can borrow money and they can see that I have the money that I can pay for it. The difference between the both is kind of confusing because why would I get into so much debt to get more debt here versus I really could use the money, but you're not giving me because you're saying that I don't have the collateral to pay it back. Those two spectrum and how you're raised about how money should work for you is completely different. You're living day by day for dollar versus here is you can save up and make more money. Or, you know, if you put your money here, it's going to make more money for you. And then you're just going to sit there and work.
So pick any number you want, but I'll just throw a number, you know, and this may not work for the analogy, but somebody in Kenya, and again, we're going to generalize here, gets $100,000 given to him today. What are they going to do with that? Are they just going to hide it?
There's a gentleman who died and had 700,000 shillings under his mattress because that's what he would do. It's easier to have it there and you can see it and you can touch it versus take it to the bank. And there's a lot that I'm glossing over and not describing to it. Is also like the relationship with the banks and the people and how that works as well. If I keep my money in the bank in Kenya, I pay to get my money. Every time I withdraw money, I get charged to withdraw my own money. So that speaks to it. Every time I send money through M-Pesa, I get charged. The person withdrawing the money gets charged. It just becomes a whole lot of different relationship with that. So do you want to keep paying fees and fees and fees, or do you just want to keep it under your mattress and be like, oh yeah, here's $20. That's what you needed for this. You want to go buy sugar? Here we go. This is the cash that you have. So perspective on that.
Well, I am hopeful that, and we won't name any names on here, but I personally, and my wife and I have invested in what you'd call financial inclusive institutions and are trying to, I think that stats something like 2 billion people in the world are not in the banking system, which creates just a world of problems. So
about 97% of Kenyans are unbanked. So that's a big number. The majority of the population in Kenya is between 19 and 35.
You know, and the challenge is, as you look at these areas like that, where capital is needed, and when you're dealing with people who don't have a lot of capital, like to be investing in that space is really important. But it's also, it's dangerous in the respect that oftentimes people think you're doing it and you're just abusing or trying, and you're like, well, somebody has got to go do this. And so it's an interesting conundrum. I got in a conversation the other day about that. It's like, well, is that predatory? And it's like, no, great question. But if you just stay away and don't invest and don't, then it doesn't get any better. So you need to go in with a head and a heart and try to help these people in a win-win scenario, rather than just shying away because the publicity is going to be horrible. And of course, everybody's going to throw the cheap seats that you're trying to exploit these people. And clearly people do, but not everybody does. And we need more of those not everybody does going into these difficult spots.
Yeah, very true.
All right. So we're going to end this on this. If you could have one dream come true for your life, what would it be? Besides how we got started, which is you looking for a husband.
Oh, yeah.
Let's just assume that's going to happen so you can take that off your bucket list.
Okay, now I have to think differently.
Now you got to rethink.
One dream that would come true, to me, it's just financial inclusion, especially in Kenya. When I go home, I go to Kenya every year. The reason I do that is because it humbles me. It gives me a different perspective. I sit here sometimes and I complain about how hot it is in the summer. Or I complain about my AC is not working today. I remember catching myself as soon as I landed at the airport in Nairobi. There was no AC. And I was like, oh my gosh, where's the AC? And I was like, Marianne, come back to earth. You're in Kenya. I go to my mom's house. She didn't have a microwave at that time. And I have to go start the fire, then warm up my food. In my head, I'm like, Where's the microwave? I have to hand wash clothes when I go to Kenya. It's fun, but your hands are miserable after. But the fact that I can walk around barefoot at night, it is so quiet. I can see all the stars. I wake up in the morning. It's so green, hilly. It feels great. But what I notice every time I'm going to, we call them centers, not even towns, because it's just a mom and pop shop. You have like a hardware store right there. It's just a small, small center. I noticed that there's a lot of women are running small businesses, you know, selling vegetables, selling clothes and things like that. But at the end of the day, that money doesn't go that far. It goes to either you buy dinner that day or it goes to buying uniform for your kids. And you have goals. You want your kids to go to like a good school. Most of the good schools, you have to pay money for it, like boarding schools. So you're choosing between, does this money go to school? Does it go to buying a different kind of meal tonight? Or does it go into school uniform for my kid? Or do I reinvest it into the business? So you end up getting a loan from through your phone, and those loans are crazy. The interest rates are crazy. And then you're just being charged interest rate over interest rate. And at the end of the day, when you go do your business, someone wants to pay you via phone. You can't take that payment via phone because it's going to go paying off your loan and you don't have food at home. While if you have someone who believes in you and there's access to that capital, you could borrow the money, do with your business and pay it back over time without having the rush of what do I choose to do and how do I change the method of getting paid tomorrow? So I was raised by a woman. I have seen firsthand how girl child in Kenya can survive. I had 13 girlfriends when I was growing up from class 1 to class 8. By the time I was in high school, only 2 of us out of the 13 went to high school. When I graduated from high school, I'm the only one who went to college. The rest, those kids that I started school with, they have children. Because, you know, you get dowry when you get married, your family gets dowry. That dowry is either sold so that the son can go to school or it's used to pay his dowry. So in that environment, how do you encourage your daughter to be good at anything? Or how do you encourage your daughter that you can have anything that you want in life? So inclusion would be the one thing that I will advocate for, and having that source of not only providing you the capital, but teaching you how to be successful in making that business work. That would be a great, like teaching people the value of that money, your relationship with money, changing your perspective on how that looks like, and a lot of unlearning. I had to unlearn a lot of things when I got to the States, and I'm still unlearning a lot of that, but I've also learned a lot of new things that if I had that perspective when I was growing up, and if someone told me how I can change my perspective on how I relate to money, it would change a lot of how I would have looked at life in Kenya.
Well, there's somebody I need to introduce you to, and we can talk about this offline, but I can see, this is just me, I can see your black dot that you mentioned. I can see where it might eventually bleed out, and I'm guessing that working in Kenya, maybe here from the U.S., but specifically in that field of financial inclusion would be really cool to see. Obviously, you got the background in so many different ways. So I'm going to be rooting for you.
Thank you.
In my own way of what that dot should look like. Well, look, I so appreciate you coming on and giving us some perspective of who you are and just what it's like living in Africa versus here. I'm going to end in a way I don't normally do. If you were to give an American one bit of advice from an African, what would you say to them? And it could be whatever you want, but maybe I'm thinking around culture and just, you know, what is one thing that as American I need to learn from an African?
Oh my gosh, there's a lot of things that I would say, I would put to that.
You can give me a couple.
Number one, usually for me, for the most part, is the assumption that Africa is just a place where there's a lot of poor people. Even in the commercials on how to help people in impoverished countries, they always choose like the most weirdest scenarios. A kid sitting there with snot coming out of his nose and flies all over his face. I'm like, we are strong enough to just like slap the fly off your face. It doesn't have to sit there forever. It's a beautiful country. Just like any other place, the continent itself, it's beautiful. It's got different cultures. It has different ideas. It has different things that it can offer. What you get from Senegal in West Africa versus what you're getting from East Africa is completely different. But the one thing that I will tell you, you will enjoy the food no matter where you are in Africa. People are always happy because a lot of the times, if you have food on the table, you're happy. As long as there's food on the table, that's a happy family. In as much as we don't have toothbrushes, Jeff, we have white teeth.
Yeah, wait. So you guys don't use toothbrushes?
We do use toothbrushes.
Okay.
Just, you go cut off a tree, chew the top, and just brush your teeth.
That's how you do it. I'm looking at your teeth, and I'm not kidding you, relative to mine, I'm like, yours are like pearly white. Mine are like, looks like I smoke, and I don't smoke.
No, in as much as not everyone can afford to buy a toothbrush from this store, we do brush our teeth with like sticks, and they work magic.
That's fascinating. That's a good one. I love that. I did not realize that.
Just note, every time you see an African, check out their teeth. Trust me, it's always white.
Is there a specific type of tree or does it matter?
It usually is. You find that when you go there, like some, they're like, oh yeah, take that one. That's the one that does this and this. It starts out this way and this way. But I remember going to school, we used to have specific ones that you would use in the morning. Then after, when you're walking back from lunch, you pick up another one and you're just like brushing your teeth, heading to school.
Which is crazy because you think about, we've got one of those electric toothbrushes, whatever. And I think you get a pack of like the heads, like a pack of, I don't know what it is, what are eight of it, let's just say. And it's like $60. You're like, this is nuts. So yep. I'm going to start going down to the front yard. Like, Shelly, we're just going to do this.
Every morning, like someone wakes up and that's the first thing they're doing. Just, you know.
Then my gums will just be bleeding at that point. So
start bleeding. And then after a while, you
they won't bleed anymore. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Well, again, thanks for your time, and it's been a pleasure. So we appreciate what you've shared with us today. So don't forget to subscribe to New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice, and please rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on a path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. Till next time, I'm Jeff Schaefer. This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.